All right. We were talking about the earthquake as we ended, and we'll get on to the Pike area. But relating to what I can remember of the earthquake hit very severely in Long Beach. We had Marshall Guards. The fleet was in Long Beach at that time, and the sailors came in and were set up to keep looting down. All the storefronts busted open. The people were trying to get out. People were trying to give their property away. I don't want it. Here, take the deed to my house. You can have it. I've got to get out of here. My grandmother was living at 921 Alamitos when the earthquake hit, and we were living in the 5900 block on California. My father got in an old touring car that we had at that time and drove down to get my grandmother after dark. I believe it was 5:20 p.m. that the earthquake hit, if I remember rightly. Anyway, people were camped in groups in the vacant land around. We had bonfires and tents were being put up. People were expecting the end of the world to come. We had no one who knew what had happened in our area. No one had ever been in an earthquake before. We had one man, I remember, preaching that the world was coming to an end. And people were concerned. They thought the world was coming to an end. And as a small child, I was confused. I wondered what was going on. I can remember while my father was down getting my grandmother that there were people that drove up the street yelling, tidal wave, get out. And this caused great commotion and concern to people. One of the boys in the neighborhood who I played with, his mother worked at the old Tracy Theater down on Pine Avenue, and she was a ticket taker. And the downtown area was in, the fronts had fallen off in the stores, the fascia was put on without any securing pins to the rock and the stone and the brick, and it just fell into the streets. I can remember going up and down 2nd Street, 3rd Street, and 4th Street. At those times, there were many brick buildings with brick faces on them. And the fronts of the buildings just fell into the street. And you could drive down the street or walk down the street and look up, and you could look into a person's front room, or you would see a bathroom. You could see the old tub there and the wash basin and the stool from the street side, and you would walk by and there was someone's bed sitting there. There were buildings that the foundations fell out from underneath of them. They were shaken such that they were shaken off from their foundations if the foundations were strong enough. The armory, which is still the armory at the corner of 7th Street and California, was the morgue in those days, and that's where they took the dead people. There were many injuries around. The hospitals were without the proper facilities. I can remember talking to a man at one of the hospitals, and he said he was shaving at the time, and he didn't get finished shaving until 2 days later, until he got back to where that was important. I'm sure he had time between that time and the 2 days later, but every other things were more important to him. Anyway, about midnight of that night, we left and in our car to go to an area out by Rancho Las Migas, which is called, in those days, it was called Gloria Gardens. We had some relatives there, and we camped there overnight. But on the way, we stopped to get gasoline. And the people were giving gasoline away at the service stations. There were long lines of people waiting to get gas, and they were scared that the tanks would rupture. And they thought that by emptying them, it would be the safe thing to do instead of the worst thing to do. And so, like, you know, we filled up our car, and the man wouldn't take any money. And we drove out to my cousin's house, and we stayed all night there in the field. And the next day, we drove on over to Colton, where my grandfather lived. And that same evening, which would be March the 11th, one of the relatives had a large black Phaeton, or a convertible, with a spotlight on it. And all of the men got in this car and came back to Long Beach. And they put a piece of red cellophane over the spotlight and turned it on. And everyone would just wave them on through. And they drove through Long Beach at that time down the streets before anything was cleaned up. And were looking over the things that I later saw. Earlier in my conversation, I talked about the private water companies in North Long Beach. Well, the one that we were on, north of South Street, we could not use our water after the earthquake to drink. They were scared because of the old lines and because of the sanitation for us to drink that water. In fact, for the first week after we came back, we stayed gone about a week, but for the next week when we came back, we didn't have any water. There was no water in the pipes. And we would have to go down to where the Long Beach water was, which was on South Street at the service station where my father traded. And they sold Gilmore gasoline. I can always remember the big lion there at the Gilmore station. And we would get our drinking water and water to wash dishes with and what have you. At that time, I can remember they would save the dishwater and use it to flush the toilet with at that time, so to conserve upon the water that was being used. We didn't use our hot water tank at any time during that time. In fact, as I think back on it, we didn't have an automatic water heater. When you wanted to heat water in the water tank for a bath, well, that's the only time you lit the water heater. The rest of the time, the water was heated on a tea kettle on the stove. The newspaper that came out after the earthquake, I remember seeing one, and it showed the buildings that had not been damaged, the large buildings in the city of Long Beach, and there was a very small number of them. And two of the buildings that I can remember as a boy that were not damaged, one of them was the villa, and the other one was the Salvation Army building that was on Locust Avenue. I believe this building was about in the 400 block. It's now a parking lot. They tore the building down in the past 15 years or so, maybe 20, and the Salvation Army relocated their offices up on Spring Street between Atlantic and Long Beach Boulevard. Now, to get back to the Pike area or the Plunge area, I was thinking about, as a small child and as a young man, swimming, diving off in the Cyclone Racer, before they put in the breakwater, the water used to break under there and the breakers and ride the breakers into the beach. I would jump in, not dive in. And some of the braver ones would dive in, and we would ride the breakers in to the beach. There was a long ride when the tide was in. We could ride the breakers in a long ways into the beach. Well, we would go to the Plunge down there, the old Plunge building, and they would stamp us, and then we could go out on the beach and swim. And there was a tunnel that went from the Plunge down underneath the walk there and out onto the sand. And we would go out there and swim for a while, and then we'd come back in, and they had an area where you had to walk through foot baths and water, and they had the water continually spraying there, and it was cold seawater, as I remember it. And I used to hate to go back into the plunge to get my clothes to leave because the water was so cold after being out in the warm sun and on the sand. In the early days, I can remember one or two incidents down on the beach of people grounding and the lifeguards getting them out and literally putting them on a barrel and trying to roll the water out of them to get them to come back to life. They had absolutely no success with this thing. I can remember all the people standing around yelling, do this and do that. But it was rather a futile thing because the people were dead from the time they got them out of the water, and the way they were going about it, they were killing them very fast if they hadn't have been. After they built the Rainbow Pier, and the water would come in when we would have high tides and big breakers, and it would hit the side of the pier and fly up over the top of it, the water would to the inside. You could, and all the stores along the pike there had their own sandbags. In those days, they didn't depend upon anyone to help them. If they wanted to keep the water out of their stores, they filled their own sandbags and put them up in front of the store, and this kept the water out on extremely high tides. But later, as they built the breakwater, then the sand started to build up, and there was dredging and stacking of sand, and the tides quit coming in onto the businesses down there on the pike. And consequently, the beach, we could walk for a long ways out without dropping off suddenly. When I was talking about that ship that came and went to Catalina that tied up to the old double-decker pier, at the end of this pier also was a dance hall. I've forgotten the name of it, but I can remember going there with my grandmother and sitting while she would dance. And they would, her and my grandfather would dance and have a very enjoyable evening, and I would sleep on one of the benches that was around the dance floor. There were also a group of people that gathered in the downtown area, and this area was called the Spit and Argue Club. And if you had something to say, you just would put your name up, and you were allowed a certain length of time to get up and state what you believed, regardless of what it was. You could give your opinion, and people were allowed to ask you questions and to argue with you for a period of time. And if they were interested, the time didn't mean much. But if they weren't interested, they had a time limit, and they'd say, your time's up, and you had to give up the platform, and someone else's turn to talk on their favorite subject. And later, after the people had argued and discussed the world politics or the local politics, the people would gather together in the evening down by the old band shell, and the municipal band would play, and they would have a community sing. And they had a lot of fellowship between the people and of that time.
What you told about what kind of jobs your father had, what did your mother do? Did she work or what?
During most of my childhood, my mother was a homemaker, but for a short time during the Depression, she was one of the ladies that worked in the fire station, in fire station number 12, and she sewed out there, ran one of the power sewing machines. I can remember her coming back and telling what a great thing it was that they had a power sewing machine. She had never been around a power sewing machine before. During the war, she worked at Douglas as an assembler for a period of time. When there was a tremendous demand for people to do anything. to come and work in the defense plants and help the war effort. We were talking earlier of the war effort, of the things that went on here. We were talking about rent controls. Well, one of the ways they got around rent control, a building would have been rented for $35 a month, and so the rent was frozen at $35 a month. So the landlord would say, all right, I'm going to rent this apartment to two couples. And he would rent the front room for $35 a month, and he would rent the bedroom for $35 a month. And that's the way he got around the rent controls. Other people would say, I'll rent you this house for $35 a month, but you have to buy the furniture. And it costs you $700 to buy the furniture, but you do not own the furniture. I can remember when I came home being in the Navy, and I didn't have any food stamps. So I went down to the ration board, and they gave me food stamps for sugar and food stamps for coffee and food stamps for meat. And I took them home and gave them to my mother, and how happy they were to get these food stamps, because they seemed that they gave us a bigger portion of food stamps for the time that we were home than what the civilians were receiving.
What's the first job you can remember having yourself?
The first job that I ever worked at, I went to work for the cafeteria at Douglas when I was in high school. I worked part-time as a busboy in the cafeteria at Douglas. It was very easy to get a job anywhere. I worked for them probably a year. And then there was jobs were so hard to find, were so easy to find at that time, and people were so hard to find, that there was a man that owned a feed store in our neighborhood who came and interviewed me and tried to talk me into quitting working for Douglas to come work for the feed store. And I told him that I didn't think that I could get a release from Douglas to go to work for the feed store. Because in those days, in order to go from one job to another, you had to have a slip of paper from a labor board. I've forgotten the name of it now. But to go from one job to another, if it was with the war effort, you had to be released from it. And this slip of paper allowed you to go to work for the other people. Otherwise, you would be eligible to be drafted, or you would, there were other repercussions, and I do not remember what the repercussions were on this. But I then later quit there and went to work in the plant. I quit school in the 11th grade, decided that I would enlist in the Navy, and I went to work for Douglas for a very short while, and enlisted in the Navy. And after the war, I went back to night school and finished my high school education, and then went on and took a couple of years of college by going to night school. The first job I had after I got out of the Navy, I worked for the Ford Motor Company as an assembler, and we were on strike more than what we were working. They had a lot of labor trouble, and I got tired of that, and then I went to work in a market. And I worked in markets for about 5 years, and then I went to driving truck for Graham Brothers, delivering concrete, and I worked at that about 5 years. And I decided that maybe I should look at something that had a little future in it. So I went down and took the test for the fire department, and I passed at rather a high place on the list. And during the interim, I quit driving truck and went to work for the Texaco refinery. And I worked at Texaco until I got called to the fire department. And I went to work at the fire department in 1956, where I am presently employed.
Did you talk about what you did when you were in the Navy?
No. During the time that I was in the Navy, they gave us a series of tests to see what you were best suited for, and they decided that I had mechanical ability, and so they sent me to diesel school in Chicago. There was a pier there called Navy Pier. It was at the foot of Grand Avenue, and I went to diesel school there, and from there I was assigned to amphibious craft. I trained in Solomons, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., and from there we went to the South Pacific. I was never in on any invasions, but I was in the support group at Aniwita and Kwajalein. We were at Ulithi in the 8th Fleet. I wasn't at Kwajalein. That's incorrect. I was at Okinawa and Saipan, and then we went on to the Philippines, and I returned to the States from the Philippines.
And your next job was after the Navy?
Oh, after the Navy, I talked about working at a grocery store, and then from the grocery store, I talked about working at Graham Brothers, driving a ready-mix truck.
I thought you worked at the Ford plant right after you.
This is first. Okay. That's correct. I'm sorry. I worked Ford first, the Ford plant first.
Okay. Was that the one in the harbor?
Yes, that's the one in the harbor where they had the fire in about 1955. They had a large fire there, and that was just before I went to work as a fireman. I was working at Texaco at the time.
And during the time you were at Ford, the UAW was organizing, or what?
No, no. They organized in 1941, I believe it was. There was a man that I worked with there that was one of the original people that went on strike, and he showed me a check for the time that he was not working from the time he went on strike until they became unionized. And they had to pay him for all the time that he was not working. This was part of the settlement. At that time, I cannot remember the amount of money it was, but he had pictures of himself being the lone picket, walking the picket line. And it was over a period of 3 or 4 years that this man was on strike, along with a lot of other people. But they discriminated against him because of his union affiliation. And he received all this back money at a later date from him. And at that time, he was the union president of that particular local.
But you said there was labor trouble when you were...
All right. Any time a part would come through that was not made in a union-recognized shop, they would shut down and would not put that part in the car. Well, right after the war, they were getting parts anywhere they could. We were actually building the same car that they built when they shut down in 1941 or early 42. And so they were using the same parts and the same dies, and everyone was trying to get their tooling up. Well, if the parts came from a shop that was not union, we would quit. If they wanted to increase production to a certain point where the union didn't think they should, or if they said something to someone about something, everyone would just lay down their tools and walk off the job. The arbitration was very poor. The union was very strong. And the company had absolutely no rights at that time. Now, I'm a strong union person. I believe in unions. I believe in what the unions have done for the laboring man. But they were trying to kill the goose that laid the golden egg at that time. They were being unreasonable. They didn't stop to think that these things had to be worked out because we'd just been in a great war and there was a great turmoil at that time. They were scared of what had happened in the 30s when the strike breakers had been there and when the Ford Motor Company had just told them that he would never sign with the union. He didn't care what happened. And so these men that were working there, the older men, they ran things. Us, the younger men that were back from the service and what have you, just went along with whatever the older fellas said. They said, let's go, we're going on strike, and we went on strike. Okay, after the Ford Motor Company, then I went to work for the Ralph's Grocery Company. I worked in the grocery business for approximately 5 years. I was a clerk, and then I was a cashier. I stocked shelves. I ran a produce department for a short while.
Did you go into the retail clerk training?
Yes, that's right.
What did you think about them relative to UAW?
I thought they were a much more sensible group of people. They were calmer. They would be more reasonable. I worked there 5 years, was never on strike, went from working at $40 a week to working to making $85 a week, went from having no medical plan to one of the finest medical plans that anyone still has in any industry. And all this was accomplished without a strike. I remember we worked one time for a period of several months without a contract, but all the time we were negotiating and dealing and talking, and it was understood that everything would be retroactive when we settled. I kind of think of what President Johnson said when he used to quote the scriptures, and he said, come, let us reason together. And to me, this seems like a more reasonable way of settling any difference. In the present job I'm in, I'm a union member. We call it a benevolent society because we, according to law, we have no right to strike. But our organization is strong. We're associated with the AFL. The Teamsters would like for us to become Teamsters. We do not want to become part, the majority of us, do not want to become part of the Teamsters organization. We do not want to be manipulated. We want to be people who can make up our own minds and our own decisions about our local problems. I belong to the CIO when I was an oil worker. I feel that they have, in most cases, treated the oil worker very fairly, negotiated fairly for them. They were very racist at one time in their beliefs. Contrary to what people say, I can remember sitting in union meetings and hear them say, you told us that the Mexicans and the niggers would not be promoted, and we would not represent them. They would stay as laborers or truck drivers, but that's the only positions they could ever have. They could never be foremen. Also, I can remember being in meetings where there were some ladies that were in the union at the CIO that worked in the labs. In order to get more money, they had to be able to go out and get samples out of the refinery. And they had been paying union dues. And they told them they couldn't go out there and get these samples. And so some of the people in the union were saying that we'd taken their money under false pretenses if we weren't going to battle for them. And others said, well, I thought they were just like the Mexicans and the niggers. These were the exact words that were being used in the meeting.
Was this 128? The oil workers union?
Yes, that's correct. And I sat right in the hall and heard these things being said, and I didn't know what was going on. But I knew that they were being very unfair and very racist, because anyone who is capable of doing a job is entitled to the job. But by the same token, I do not like what's going on in the government today. We are now receiving firemen that have trouble reading and writing their own name and are not capable of making good, sound judgment decisions. I'm afraid that if we continue with the process that we're continuing with, that we will decide that some of these people need to have a job of authority, because we have none of this race who are in a position of authority. And if the people that we have now are not capable of making decisions at their level, then they're not going to be able to make decisions for other people at a higher level. We need to, in unions, we need to do just like we do in schools. You're only rewarded for what you learn. And if you don't learn, you don't pass. Whether it's if you just have a fail pass or whether you have a grading method, you have to get the knowledge somewhere.
Why did you leave Ralph's?
I was fired from Ralph's. I worked there 4.5 years, and I'd been sick for 2 days, and I came back to work, and I was doing what I'd been told to do, and one of the supervisors from the Los Angeles office came down. This was a Sunday afternoon, and he looked at the vegetable area, and I was told to let the vegetables sell out. They wanted to get rid of what was there, and so I had left the vegetables there, and he wanted to know why those vegetables were in the rundown condition and weren't the fresh ones from the back room put out there. And he says, "You're fired. You're all done. You're not working here anymore." And so I wasn't working there anymore. The union didn't want me to be fired, but I said no, I didn't want to work for anyone that, who after working for anyone 4.5 years, felt that way about you, would fire you for doing what you were told to do by the store manager. And this is when I decided to change jobs. I went to work for Dollar Market 2 days later. But after that, I got out of the grocery business.
Okay.
Well, I just felt that dealing with the public, that maybe I would have a better future and a different line.
And that's when you went to work for Grandbrothers?
Yes, that's when I went to work for Grandbrothers. I drove truck for them for probably 3 years, and then I became a batch man. This is a person who loads the trucks and schedules the trucks out on the different jobs. And the thing about working in the cement business or concrete business is that it's spasmodic. You might work 60 hours 1 week and 20 hours the next. Now, at the end of the year, I was in the top 15% of the national income of the people in the United States. But I'm the type of person that has to know how much money he's going to be making and when he's going to be getting it. I actually am happier working for less money and having it steady, having something I can depend upon. This was the reason I hunted for employment at the Texas company. I was over-delivering some concrete, and I ran into a man that I had known when I was going to high school. And one of the ways that you get a job at the Texas company is having someone that works there to recommend you. This is a very important thing with them. And they do check on your background, who you are, and if all the things that you put down in your application is true. and they checked me out and said that I could come to work for them. And I worked for them approximately 22 months before I was called on the fire department. And I had a rather tough decision deciding whether to leave the Texas company to go to work for the fire department or not. But now I've seen that I've made the right choice after all these years.
What did you do at Texas?
I ended up being a gauger. You start off in the, everyone starts there in the labor gang. And then you, after they find out whether you're willing to work or not for 8 weeks, then you're allowed to go into a common labor pool, which is called a pipe gang. And if you want to stay in this area, then you can work your way up as you learn and apply yourself on up the ladder. But I chose to go into operations because it was a faster way of getting up the ladder. You could go in as an operator, and you could start making more money right away. And I went into the gauging part, which controls the storage of the product. You go around and check the tanks, the heights of them, and open valves, and move the product from one tank to another, and mix gasoline, and so on and so forth. Yes, that was AFL. That was 692 Teamsters. During the time I worked for them, it was a very peaceful time. The Teamsters have had a history of having unpeaceful times. There are times since I've left Grand Brothers that the local Teamsters have been on strike, and times before that they've been on strike. Sometimes it's a necessary thing, but sometimes it's been unnecessary when they've gone on strike. I've been a very fortunate man during my working time. I've never been on strike. None of the unions that I've ever belonged to have I ever been out on strike. I'm not saying that I wouldn't go out on strike, but I've never been out on strike. During the time I worked for Grand Brothers, I became a member of the Operating Engineers of Local 12. And the Operating Engineers is considered one of the strongest unions in the United States. Local 12 takes in four of the western states. And even while I was a member of this union, I worked for them during a peaceful time, during a time when they were not on strike. If they'd have gone out, if the majority of the membership had voted for a strike, I would have gone on the strike with them.
Okay, then you went to the fire department.
Right.
Where did they send you?
Okay, to start off with, they sent me to fire station number 7 at 23rd and Elm. They have two pieces of equipment there. They have at the time I went to work there, we had a ladder truck and a pumper, and we had the assistant chief was stationed there. And after you'd been on the job a certain length of time, one of your duties was to take your turn driving the assistant chief, being an aide to him. You drove the car, kept it clean, carried the portable radio. In those days, portable radios weren't a thing that you carried in your hand. They were a large phone-like object that had probably weighed 25 or 30 pounds. You were his communication person. The first day that I ever drove the assistant chief, we had an airplane crash at Cowles and Hayes. There was a military aircraft that crashed into a bookbinding store. We had two people killed in the bookbinding store. The pilot bailed out, and he was too close to the ground when he bailed out, and he was killed, and the radio man was injured severely. We had several people that were burnt, one which died later, making the deaths. At the end, I believe there were four people, four fatalities upon this. This is the first emergency scene that I'd ever gone to where there were any fatalities. And I'd been on the fire department probably 5 months. This was in January of 1957. And after spending 7 years at fire station number 7, I went to, they opened up a brand new fire station on Clark in the 3500 block, and I went out there to be on the ladder truck, part of the crew on the ladder truck. I was only there a very short time when they transferred me over to an engine company, fire station number 14, and I worked there approximately 5 years, and I went to the airport for further training crash firefighting, and while I was working there, I was promoted, and they moved me to fire station number 9, and from there I went to fire station number 14, where I'm still stationed.
When you came back from the Navy, where did you live?
I lived at 921 Alamitas in a little garage apartment that my grandmother had built, and this property had been willed to my sister and I. And we, for a year, we lived in this little garage apartment on the back of this. And then we decided to move out of there. My mother and father were living there, and my sister, and there was a rental there. And we decided that my folks were very domineering, and they thought that even though we were married and our boy was born there, that we were supposed to report in.
Wait a minute. You never talked about being married. Why don't you go back?
Okay, I was married in 1945, after the war was over. In August of 45, after the atomic bomb had been dropped, and at that time, no one thought that was a terrible thing to do. No one thought that we had done anything wrong by dropping an atomic bomb. We were very happy that we dropped an atomic bomb. We were elated. The atrocities that were being done against our people at that time, we felt very justified in dropping that bomb. Our people we knew of the Corregidor Death March. We knew of the things that had happened to our people. When I came back from the Philippines on a troop ship, we had a group of people aboard ship that were in psychiatric care that had come out of a concentration camp, a Japanese a prisoner of war camp. One of the men talked to us on the ship during the time and was telling us how it was. And he said that for 2 years he was denied any water to wash with, and that the urine from up above him, he was in a jail that was more than one story, and they were using the urine that was coming down to try to keep clean with it. There was no reason for this man to make up any of what he was telling us. He wasn't talking to a group of civilians or a group of people that he was trying to impress. He was talking to fellow servicemen. And he was telling about how little food they had and how they were beat for the pleasure of beating. Now, this is not putting the Japanese down in any way, because I'm sure that the atrocities that we did to people were just as bad. I know of cases of people that had killed prisoners because they didn't want to walk them X number of miles to put them in compounds. They would just shoot them and say, well, they tried to get away. We are by no means unblameless. But to get back to the bomb being dropped, there was no guilt at that time. the guilt that we put upon ourselves for dropping the bomb is something that we are looking back upon, and it's like we are worried about the man that we put in jail. It's a terrible thing to have to put anyone in jail, but it also is a terrible thing when you think about the people that he has attacked. And so we're on a moral issue. Well, I get to talking about